Very welcome to have Dr. Raymond Peake back on the show. And again, it astounds me where he has spent all of the years of his postdoctoral life researching. And this other subject tonight, carbon monoxide, is something that he said he was researching 30 years ago and started doing work towards better understanding of carbon monoxide and its implications in toxicology and pathogenesis of disease. So, Dr. MP, thanks for joining us again.
Mm-hmm. There were a couple topics that directed me towards carbon monoxide. I had previously been very interested in Otto Warburg's theory of cancer, and one of his experiments to study the respiratory enzyme involved poisoning that enzyme with carbon monoxide.
Okay.
And so I was aware that the most interesting enzyme of all happened to be specifically sensitive to carbon monoxide poisoning. And he found that light restored the activity of that enzyme, and that came back up in my attention when I was studying the toxic effects of the long northern dark winters, lack of light exposure leaving this enzyme susceptible to poisoning.
Okay. I think without cutting you short, Dr. Peake, just the other thing that strikes me is that we get callers who have listened for the first time with this show that goes out every month, and I wouldn't want anyone listening to be deprived of getting a little bit of background information from you. So I appreciate you launching straight into the topic. But would you just give people an idea of your academic and professional background?
I went from teaching linguistics and humanities subjects right into graduate school in biology because I wanted to understand how the brain works when it does things such as making language or art and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I was studying nerve biology at the beginning and found that that was a very dogmatic area, I think at every university, but including the University of Oregon, where I started in graduate school in 1968.
Okay.
And so within about 6 months, I had switched over to the other end of the organism, reproductive physiology, and how aging affects that.
Right. Okay, because I think that's another important point about this topic that I'd like you to expand on here. Aging in the process of degeneration and cell degeneration, excuse me, is, I think, probably becoming more of a heard topic on people's lips and in the papers and in magazines and in the popular press. And Alzheimer's disease being one of those neurodegenerative diseases that we're hearing much more of nowadays, to Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, and collectively that neurodegenerative collective of diseases. This is something that relates fairly intimately with carbon monoxide, doesn't it? That there is many different processes that cause or have been shown to exacerbate the formation of Alzheimer's in any given population. But
They find that old brains in general have increased amounts of the enzyme that produces carbon monoxide in the tissues.
Okay.
Any tissue can produce it, but stress increases the amount of the enzyme. And so the more stress there is, the more risk there is of poisoning itself. And not only increasing age increases the enzyme, but they find that schizophrenic brains have increased amounts of the enzyme making carbon monoxide.
Okay.
Alzheimer's brains and in Parkinson's brains, in the particular area affected by the Parkinson's disease, they see an increased amount of the enzyme. And in breaking down the heme, which is its basic purpose, it releases iron as well as carbon monoxide, and the deposits of iron are found in the Parkinson's brain in that area.
Let's just refresh for people that who probably want to understand this process a little more. The enzyme first off is heme oxygenase, isn't it?
Yeah.
And just give us a run through of what that's doing.
It attaches oxygen atoms to the heme molecule, which is what carries oxygen in hemoglobin.
Right.
The heme molecule is what binds iron, and right. that in turn binds oxygen.
Right.
But carbon monoxide is similar enough electrically to oxygen that it can outbind oxygen
and displace it
to the hemoglobin in its place.
Right.
So we can be exposed to carbon monoxide from external sources like burning fuel. But you're saying that this is also happening inside our bodies and inside our cells due to an enzyme?
It's just the only way the body has to get rid of unused or inappropriately released hemoglobin. Any time a tissue is injured and leaks blood, the hemoglobin is potentially very toxic in itself,
right.
and so to detoxify this hemoglobin, which would act as an enzyme, just wildly consuming oxygen, the enzyme is there in every injured tissue that tends to bleed or release heme to destroy the heme and turn it into things that can be recycled,
right.
Such as the iron atom and the carbons from the heme molecule.
So this enzyme has a function in damaged tissue to help mop up the waste products, but in certain brain situations like we've been describing, Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, it's in excess amounts.
Apparently because of chronic stress.
Right.
Another brain situation in which they find it exactly associated with the problematic cells in the brain, multiple sclerosis in the plaques, they find increased amounts of the enzyme making carbon monoxide. And about 20 years ago, I had gotten away from the cancer carbon monoxide connection for several years because I couldn't find anyone willing to listen to the idea that it was such a neat idea to explain how the Warburg cancer theory works.
Okay.
But I came back to it in the 90s, applying it to multiple sclerosis because the symptoms of carbon monoxide poisoning are very similar to those of multiple sclerosis.
Yeah, go ahead and describe them.
Clots tend to form in the brain, and every place there's a clot, the blood vessels become leaky, and proteins leak out into the brain and are part of the inflammatory process.
Mm-hmm.
And the carbon monoxide activates those same processes, tendency to clot, definite tendency of blood vessels to become leaky,
okay.
Let things inappropriately seep out, so that any time you have a situation of leaky blood vessels, injured liver, for example, leaking its enzymes,
mm-hmm.
inflamed muscles leaking enzymes and proteins, heart attack leaking right. its substances, you find heme oxygenase and carbon monoxide there, making the cells more permeable and leaky.
Now, am I right in thinking that carbon monoxide is actually produced by tumors too?
And in transplanting a tumor into an animal, they found that it had many toxic effects on the animal.
Mm-hmm.
For years, they talked about a toxic hormone or a cancer hormone.
Right.
And in one set of experiments, they gave a chemical to the animal receiving the tumor implant, a chemical that would inhibit heme oxygenase and stop the formation of carbon monoxide.
Right.
And to stop the toxic effects of the transplant.
Because I think we can get into that a little bit later on. There's they're looking at this as potential research, but you can see some pitfalls in some of the approach that they want to use. So
is that for a potential anti-cancer treatment?
Yeah, there are several groups working on it. They can stop cancer growth, like for a week at a time, with an injection of one of the chemicals that just turns off heme oxygenase. And they're designing many chemicals that will do it. For example, reverse structure RNA molecules that interfere with the production of the enzyme very specifically.
So then this would have possible clinical applications with Alzheimer's and
cancers.
Parkinson as well, then, if it's actually turning off that enzyme.
Yeah, all of the degenerative stress-related diseases, cancer and the brain aging.
Atherosclerosis.
And arthritis involves excess carbon monoxide, too.
Okay, so let's just go back for the benefit of the listeners listening to this program right now, who perhaps don't have the same kind of scientific background, so they can understand a little more about heme oxygenase. You mentioned that this enzyme, heme oxygenase, is part of our body, and every cell has the ability to utilize or break down, rather, the products of hemoglobin into, you mentioned iron and carbon monoxide, and then there's a pigment called bilirubin. So this is happening, our blood cells are turning over every 90 days, and the spleen mops up these blood cells constantly, breaking down the red blood cell into byproducts like the hemoglobin and carbon monoxide and bilirubin 24/7. So this is the process that is happening in our bodies anyway, but what's the mechanism behind which we're protected from the carbon monoxide?
A design feature is that having it all happen in the spleen keeps it away from your brain and heart and reproductive organs and so on. So it's
what about those people who perhaps have had a splenectomy and it's been taken out, or it's been ruptured or damaged, they don't have one?
I don't know exactly what the consequences are, but you would think that it would expose their other tissues more to effects of chronic stress.
What about when someone has like an enlarged spleen? Then are they just able to do that much better? Because usually enlarged spleens are indicating liver disease or other problems.
I imagine that as long as it's confined to the spleen, that's the main purpose of the organ is to keep it happening somewhere that the carbon monoxide has a chance to diffuse away in the bloodstream before it gets to the organs.
Yeah. Dilute it.
Okay. Just the main purpose of the talk and this discussion is, we'll get onto that as well in a little while, is that propane, if it's burnt incompletely, and the byproducts of that incomplete combustion are carbon monoxide, and environmental pollution from traffic exhaust, high in carbon monoxide. That's basically what we're looking at. Smoking, is another good example of carbon monoxide exposure.
And so, even wood smoke too, right, Dr. Pete?
Any kind of smoke. A bad stove or fireplace can put out a huge amount of carbon monoxide. And even if you have a perfectly adjusted gas stove, if you put a cold pan down on the burner so that the flame touches it, cooling the flame is going to make it release carbon monoxide.
So tell me, you had a recent encounter, or somebody you were consulting with someone, and they were lucky enough to get their hands on a good carbon monoxide meter. So just talk about that a little.
They were all having symptoms, and they noticed that they were worse in the winter when the house was tightly closed up. and they happened to have access to a very sensitive meter that would measure down to a few parts per million, and found that just 15 minutes of having the stove on, the burners were producing 15 parts per million, and the oven 29 parts per million, no, 18 and 29.
Mm-hmm.
And in it's a matter of how long you keep breathing it, because if it fluctuates, then you have a chance to breathe it out as well as breathe it in.
Mm-hmm.
And in one particular experiment with rats, they exposed the rats to the supposedly upper safe limit for human exposure,
which
for example, in cities, 50 parts 50. Per million.
Right, okay.
And in just 1 hour of exposure, the rats' brains were structurally damaged.
So were they getting infarcts or some other kind of damage? Or?
No, much less.
Much less than that, yeah.
Small cellular changes.
Right, so it's the beginning of something better, yeah. Something worse.
And that's what you mentioned is the level in a lot of cities, right? 50 parts per million.
Yeah, it comes and goes, but they saw permanent changes in prolonged exposure to even lower amounts in the animals, 30 parts per million, for example.
So the average housewife who spends all her time cooking over the stove, no, sorry, that's not the average housewife. It could be exposed to a lot more than healthy levels because gas stoves could be emitting a large quantity of carbon monoxide.
Yeah, and the symptoms are very rarely associated with carbon monoxide poisoning because that's thought of as...
You traditionally think of the person who's shut themselves in a garage with a rubber pipe coming out of their exhaust pipe into the garage, right?
Yeah, and for many years... doctors thought only in terms of the blood being saturated with carbon monoxide and not being able to deliver oxygen to the tissues.
Mm-hmm.
But the carbon monoxide goes right into all of the tissues, and we've got many, many enzymes that use heme. It isn't just the blood and myoglobin. But, for example, the steroids, the enzymes that make steroids, use the heme group, and so the most intense symptom of getting your tissue saturated is you poison the energy producing enzyme. But very moderate amounts of chronic poisoning will shut down your ability to produce steroids, so that the testosterone level, for example, falls with chronic carbon monoxide poisoning. But interestingly, the adrenal corticosteroids are increased under the stimulation because the adrenals are designed to recognize a stress emergency situation, which carbon monoxide is. But the actual enzymes that produce the bulk of steroids are blocked by carbon monoxide.
Okay, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Carbivore 91.1 FM. And from 7:30 until the end of the show at 8 o'clock, you're invited to call in with any questions, either related or unrelated to this month's topic of carbon monoxide. The number here, if you live in the area, is 923-3911. Or if you live outside the area, 1-800-KMUD-RAD. Okay, so we're joined by Dr. Raymond Pete, and he's explaining some of the mechanisms behind carbon monoxide poisoning, and we're just covering some of the sources of which perhaps we probably haven't really considered that much. So I think the thing with stoves, the cook stoves, I always recognize the fact that a poorly adjusted flame was probably the main cause of carbon monoxide emission from propane burning appliances, and that the presence of an orangey type flame rather than a blue or a kind of violet flame was indicative, and then soot and that kind of thing, sooty deposits around the nozzle were pretty diagnostic of incomplete combustion. But you're saying that if you can put a pan of water, a cold pan of water on the stove, actually on the burner, there's sufficient cooling there to cool the flame to the point where there will be incomplete combustion and carbon monoxide generated.
And typically you see a little bit of the flame turning yellow where it hits the pan.
Right, exactly, yeah. No, I think we've all seen that.
Yeah, no, I've seen that. But the other point about this carbon monoxide emissions from propane stoves is that people's houses are becoming more and more airtight. I know our house is
right,
very
airtight.
So it's, maybe the older drafty houses, a little bit leaking out of your stove, it was diluted with plenty of wind.
Plenty of air.
So do you think we're going to see more Alzheimer's now, Dr. Pete? Continue with everybody's airtight houses.
Well, we are seeing it. It's just whether or not it's coming from propane stoves or not.
But the first symptoms are often so light, people just think they have a chronic cold, or sometimes people get anxious or depressed. Some people have crawling sensations on their skin, muscle cramps, heart arrhythmia.
Okay.
Practically any symptom you can think of, it's well known as a sign of carbon monoxide poisoning, but it's just very rare for anyone to think of it when they have the symptoms.
Yeah.
Or what about those heaters that you see in a lot of people's houses?
Space heaters or something.
Yeah, that are actually gas-powered heaters. I guess maybe they're more popular in England than they are here.
A lot of people used to have them even without vents.
Well, these ones in England, people have in their house don't have any vents. Mm-hmm. It sits in the front room. Radiating heat.
Yeah, the same as a gas cooking stove. I figured it was.
So another thing to cover too is the government regulations concerning the presence of carbon monoxide detectors in houses now. I think probably for a few years, it was smoke detectors, and then it was carbon monoxide detectors. Describe briefly, because I've seen the limits and the statutory regulations, government regulations and industry regulations that have set these limits. Just describe them for us a little bit.
Years ago, I bought one of the cheap meters and was testing it on various things, and nothing would register, and so I put it in the garage with the car running and left it for, I guess, half an hour, and still nothing happened.
It wasn't strong enough.
I learned that the government requires, or the industry and government require that they not sound an alarm unless the concentration is reaching the life-threatening point. So if it's a low level, below 50 parts per million, one of the standards says it has to stay at that concentration for 48 hours steadily before the alarm can sound.
Wow.
And so what would that do to your brain if you had a 50 parts per million steadily for 24 hours, 48 hours?
I think they require the alarm to sound after something like 30 to 60 minutes of a 50 parts per million concentration. They've got the charts published, but
yeah.
It's definitely not a healthy concentration, but they don't want you bothering the fire department anytime you're just getting a burst of 70 parts per million. Because it won't kill you soon.
Or complaining to your range manufacturer.
Yeah.
So what about this meter that you said is very, very sensitive? What's the name of this meter?
I've seen it on the internet. I don't know the brand. One company that makes them is KID, or KIDDE, K-I-D-D-E.
Oh, right. They're manufacturers of smoke alarms, too.
I think it was their company that had one for $340 that actually registered down in parts per million, which is exactly useful because...
Right, and in real time.
Yeah. you want to know, for example, if you breathe out, a healthy person will make less than one part per million exhalation. Mm-hmm. If they're very sick and under stress, they might go up to 5 parts per million just from their internal production.
I'm pretty sure we have a caller on the line, but let's give it a couple of seconds here because it's not 7:30 yet, and I want to make sure that we can keep covering more material. The thing that struck me earlier when I was looking at some of this was that smoking exposes a smoker to about 500 parts per million carbon monoxide from a cigarette.
Yeah, so, in that little stream.
Right. So let's try to be comparative here and. In terms of incomplete combustion from a propane stove, and you said 28 parts per million for the oven and 18 for the...
If you had that concentration of the cigarette in your room air, you would be dead pretty quick.
Right. At 500 parts per million.
Right.
Because you're breathing quarts of air for every puff of smoke.
Right, so it's very diluted. So what do you think, what would that, I wonder what a quart to a puff would work out at as a concentration?
Probably 30, 40, 50, somewhere around that.
So standing around your oven could be just as bad as smoking cigarettes?
Definitely in some houses.
If the oven's adjusted.
Let's take this first caller if they're still there. Hi, you're on the air?
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, can barely hear you.
Okay, well, yeah.
But I can hear you.
Okay, good. Go ahead.
A question for Raymond Pete, probably two or a couple, but I recall a couple years ago he was talking about he had something with thyroid and staying off clear oils, and he was curing liver. People with liver problems, say had cirrhosis or hepatitis or something.
Yeah, that's true. Yep. What would be your question?
What was it again? The
what oils are
something
you?
Something about thyroid, and I'd like to know what to refurbish my memory, my mind as to what his what was he recommends as a liver cleanse, and I recall that it was something with thyroid medicines. No clear oils, coconut and butter only, and no alcohol or some blah blah blah.
Okay, Dr. P, did you catch that?
The thyroid is the essential thing for energizing the burning of any fuel, and if your thyroid function is low, your liver is. In a way, the first organ to feel it because the liver stores sugar, and if you're wasting energy, your liver fails to store sugar and becomes inefficient eventually, fibrotic and so on.
People with thyroid, I knew a woman in New York, she went from really real thin to super fat, so she had her thyroid gland removed. And she had an awful scar in her throat. It didn't help her at all. But anyway, I'm not overweight or anything. It's just that I've had hepatitis in the past, and I'm afraid I may, you know, I used to drink for, you know, over 20 years all day long. So I'm wondering how I can, what is this thyroid medicine called?
There are two main chemicals that are called the thyroid hormone. One is thyroxine, and the other one is T3, or triiodothyronine. And the traditional product was just dried thyroid gland.
And, you actually take the gland itself?
People used to eat the whole animal.
I heard you on the radio, so maybe 4 years ago now, and you're saying take thyroid. It's like, gee, I don't have any thyroid glands in my, you know, refrigerator. What is this guy talking about?
I know. In England, you can still go to the butcher, and they call them sweetbreads, and they're thymus and thyroid gland.
Sweetbreads. Okay, that's swell. But see, I haven't eaten meat since I was like 17.
Well, you can't get them here anyways. It's just a factoid I thought I'd bring up.
Okay.
Okay, so.
Long story short, what should I do here?
The main dietary things that suppress the thyroid function are the polyunsaturated fatty acids. And that's why I've mentioned the importance of saturated fats such as coconut oil and butter and sugar as a way to make your own fat to avoid the dietary oils such as safflower, soy, corn oil, and so on, which are anti-thyroid.
So those are all the...
oil.
So in other words, I don't really necessarily... I'm sure my thyroid is probably functioning just fine. I have a sneaking suspicion. I mean, are you... are you the guy on the internet I was trying to get hold of where it's a photo of you and you look like all like you've been working out or something? Is that you?
No.
I'm like, this could not be my guy. This does not sound like Ray Pete to me. But there's another Ray. I spoke to you on the internet of several years ago, but I can't find you anymore on the internet.
Well, his website is raypete.com, R-A-Y-P-E-A-T.com.
Right. Okay. Groovy.
Yeah, so it's all the liquid oils. So it wasn't the... You remembered correctly everything, apart from that it was liquid oils, not clear oils. It's all liquid oils.
Yeah, liquid oils. None.
Avoiding all liquid oils.
Yeah,
only
no
do butter and coconut oil.
And so then I have to lay off alcohol completely, any kind of drugs, crap, shit, stuff, pardon my language. And
adequate protein.
My policy is if you swear on air, I take you off. So we have one more caller waiting now.
What do I do about thyroid again?
Okay, one more caller. You're on the air?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi. I had a question about something Dr. Pete brought up before. He was talking about hypothyroid and how it can be improved in, like, warm, sunny weather. I was just wondering, is that beneficial because it's temporarily, like, masking the symptoms, or if that has a long-term corrective effect on the thyroid?
Just getting warm lowers the stress hormones, and so it gives your body a chance to recover. But if you haven't changed your diet that was causing the problem, then cold weather or other stress will tend to bring back the hypothyroidism.
But isn't it also that the decreased daylight hours, Dr. Pete, make your thyroid hormone less able to be picked up by your cells?
The mitochondria that I was talking about, the toxic effects of darkness, the thyroid is trying to keep those mitochondria functioning, and during the darkness, the various toxins, including carbon monoxide, interrupt the function of the mitochondrion, and that means it blocks the function of the thyroid. But if you increase your thyroid, you can compensate a little bit for that disruption during the darkness. In animal experiments, they found that removing a rat's thyroid gland, they would have to give four times as much supplement in the winter as in the summer because of the increased stress of the dark days. And when I tested it on myself, it was exactly four times requirement difference according to the season.
Yeah, and if you asked your doctor, they wouldn't recommend that you increase your thyroid medication four times in the winter months versus the summer. So something that you have to... follow your own symptoms.
Right. So it's almost as if the thyroid is being wasted on trying to help the mitochondria when you're getting less light, I guess. You're producing a similar amount. It's just being wasted on trying to keep your energy up with these stressors.
It does spend more of the thyroid substance and get it thrown off. But if you have your tissue well saturated with the safe nutrients rather than the dangerous polyunsaturated oils, your mitochondria are much tougher. They've found that you can remove the mitochondria from an animal that hasn't had those unsaturated fats, and mitochondria survive in the test tube much longer and are more vigorous. So it's the polyunsaturated fats that make the mitochondria so susceptible to injury.
Do you think, Dr. Pete, that this is because of the lipid membrane that the mitochondria is surrounded by is made up of saturated oils that don't oxidize like polyunsaturates, and that's why they last longer?
Well, the very structure, you can extract the all of the fat from a cell, and you still have the mitochondrial structure in shape because it's mostly protein that gives the structure, and those proteins are tightly interacting with fats, and a lot of those are unsaturated. And so if you get too many unsaturated ones, they oxidize and damage the proteins.
Right.
So it's the mixture of protein and fat.
And just to explain for our listeners who might not have heard of mitochondria before, that's what we call the powerhouse of our cell. It's what produces energy. So without mitochondria, you'd have no energy. You wouldn't be alive. But it's actually the part of the cell that makes all your energy. And thyroid hormone helps bring oxygen to the cell and helps to activate the mitochondria. So it's all linked to having a cell function properly. Thyroid and adequate oxygen and the mitochondria producing the energy called ATP.
And adequate light is part of it.
Yeah. Okay. All right, thanks for that caller. That reminds me, we've got one more caller, but quickly let me just ask you this, Dr. Pete. I know you mentioned Otto Warburg in 1926 and his work on cancer and defective respiratory enzymes. You said that when these animals had been poisoned with carbon monoxide, the animals could recover completely if they was, and you've mentioned this many times before in context of radiation and other damaging substances, but these animals could be restored basically by having this bright orange light. In this instance, there's red work too, but orange light shined on them, they could be reactivated, if you like.
Warburg was just using tissues isolated from animals, but Russians were the ones who used whole animals, and they would give them a killing dose of gamma rays, and if they very quickly, within an hour, flooded them with red light, it inactivated the effects of the radiation.
Right.
So it wasn't the radiation itself, it was a cascade of chemical events that could be interrupted by the red light. And when you get sunburned, part of that cascade of events is the production of carbon monoxide.
Mm-hmm. All right, so it was Otto Warburg did tissues. He was experimenting with tissues rather than animals. Okay, we have another caller on the line, so let's take the next caller.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to go back to that. The topic of the polyunsaturated fats, and I wondered if they feed chickens, for example, even organic ones, lots of, say, cottonseed meal or something, even if it's organic, are we eating organic protein, you know, chicken or beef or anything, even if they've been raised on grains and everything, are we getting a secondary exposure to a lot of polyunsaturated fats?
Any animal that isn't a ruminant will express in its tissues pretty exactly the balance of fats in its food, and that includes people and pigs and chickens.
And ducks and geese and turkeys.
Yeah, but sheep and cows and camels, for example, will produce milk that has almost about 98% of the bad fats have been destroyed by bacteria in their rumens, so that it's 98% monounsaturated or saturated, or the trans fat variations, conjugated linoleic acid, for example, which is actively being sold as an anti-cancer weight loss agent, but you find it naturally in butter and milk.
And also that would include venison, elk, antelope, mule deer, moose. You know,
and all those animals have a fats that congeal at room temperature.
They have ruminant processes working.
Yeah, because they have more than one stomach to digest to convert the fat.
But when you
see
chickens, they have such soft, almost runny fat these days.
Right, because it's very polyunsaturated because they're eating corn and soy meal.
It's the same with pig fat. When my grandmother used it, it was a solid like butter.
Mm-hmm.
And even most researchers have been calling it a saturated fat now for 50 years. And a couple of years ago, someone bothered to analyze it and found that it was 30% PUFA.
Wow.
Uh-huh. Well, we had some friends who butchered a pig that was fed mostly apples.
And vegetables from,
and
from,
vegetable
the, from the farm.
Green waste from their farm. And they had a 70-pound pig. And 30 pounds of it was fat and 40 pounds of it was meat. And it was all solid.
So that would be like good quality lard.
Yeah, that would be exactly. That's where your lard would come from for baking pastries and other goodies.
That's the way to make good eggs, too. Feed them lots of vegetable matter.
Right.
Because the sugars will cause the animals to make saturated fat. So if you feed, you know, your animals your excess fruit in the fall, which is what was happening with this pig.
Mm-hmm.
Then they'll tend to make saturated fat out of that sugar.
Well, thank you for your answers. That's very interesting. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for your call.
Yeah.
Bye.
Okay, so we have another caller on the air, so let's take this next one.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air?
Yeah. People are... Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. People tend to be really skittish about butter. I hear all the time people saying, I mustn't eat butter because I'm afraid of the cholesterol and it's going to clog my arteries and give me a heart attack. And yet you guys are always talking about how butter is good for you. Mm-hmm. What's with all that?
Dr. Pete, we've gone through this several times.
It's
but let's
brainwashing.
Go through it again. Yeah, exactly. It's just hard
to
overcome.
They wanted to sell margarine.
A researcher in India noticed that in his area where people eat a lot of butter, alcoholics didn't get hepatitis and cirrhosis. And so he did a study with rats and fed them butter and lots of alcohol, and they didn't get hepatitis and cirrhosis. And a group has been researching that now for about 25 years, showing that fish oil and unsaturated vegetable oil interact with a little bit of alcohol to activate iron, causing oxidative damage, liver inflammation, and fibrosis. But if you have practically an unsaturated fat-free diet, alcohol is really pretty harmless.
And didn't they do that study in Chicago as well 30 years ago you told me about?
Nanji is the name of of the main researcher, Nanji.
Okay, you're listening to Ask Your Herb Doctor on KMUD Garberville 91.1 FM, and from now until 8 o'clock at the end of the show, you're invited to call in with any questions related or unrelated to the month's topic of carbon monoxide poisoning and its various ramifications. Number, like I said, if you live here, is 923-3911. Or if you live outside the area, 1-800-KMUD-RAD. And we have Dr. Raymond Pete with us, and he's the person who's behind all the science. So if you would like to ask him any questions, now's your chance. We do have another caller on the air, so let's get this next caller. Hi, you're on the air?
Good. Hi. Is it I that's on the air?
Yes, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
I'm not hearing anyone.
Okay, we can hear you.
But you should be there. Are you there, caller?
Yes,
you're on the air.
Hello, caller. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can now. Yes, I had a question. I've had quintuple bypass surgery, and I was introduced to a diet called the Dean Ornish diet. And in that diet, it claims that, you know, fat is good for you in limitations, but saturated fat itself is no good at all, and that you should steer away from any saturated fat. I realize you've addressed this numerous times. You just mentioned that with the last caller. But is there something I'm just so confused at this point. You know, it's the Dean Ornish diet, from my understanding, is basically a vegetarian diet, although he does call for the fat from the, from fish to be added to that diet. But beyond that, it's a no meat, no dairy diet.
Dr. P, what would you have to say?
That there is now a lot of stuff on the internet. Chris Masterjohn, for example, has some very good review articles dealing with topics like that. I've got a couple articles on cholesterol on my website.
Okay. So Chris Masterjohn, if the caller heard that, you should Google Chris Masterjohn, and then Masterjohn, and then Dr. Raymond Peet's website is www.raypeet.com, and he has a lot of articles there that you can read that might explain some of the confusion.
But he specifically said he has articles on cholesterol.
Specifically.
And basically, research has shown that if you're eating the unsaturated fatty acids, those go rancid in your bloodstream and damage your arteries, and then your body needs to stop that massive free radical reaction where it's consuming oxygen and going rancid, and so your body puts a cholesterol bandage over the rancid oil. So Japanese scientists have found when they remove that cholesterol bandage, they find a plaque of oxidized omega-6 oils. And there's lots of research showing that this is actually what causes damage to the arteries, and it's not at all saturated fats, because saturated fats are so stable and would not create a free radical reaction like that.
Okay, I think we have two more callers on the air, so let's take the next caller. You're on the air?
Yeah, I'm calling back because when I asked about cholesterol, you talked about alcohol and liver. And what I want to know is about specifically butter. Is butter bad for your arteries and your cholesterol, or not?
Not at all, no, not at
all. A lot of people are very afraid to eat butter because they think it's going to clog their arteries. What's the reality?
Okay, did you want to answer that, Dr. P?
The same thing that applies to the liver applies exactly to the arteries, except the arteries are the first place that the unsaturated oxidized fats will injure. Right. They come out of your...
I understand that it's bad to do this to the unsaturated fats, but why do people think that butter and, and animal fat is going to clog their arteries?
Because of 50 years of propaganda from the seed oil industry, basically.
Yeah. So you're basically saying that unsaturated fat will clog your arteries quicker than butter.
Yeah.
Exactly. And when the seed oil industry was unable to sell their oils to the paint companies, and that because the paint companies started buying their oils from the petroleum industry, they needed to market their corn and soy oil to humans because there was no other market for it. And that's when Mr. Mazzola would drink a cup of corn oil and say, it's great stuff, it lowers your cholesterol. And he unfortunately died at a very young age of a heart attack. So it caused such an arterial blockage. But basically they needed to sell their oils, and they boycotted all tropical oils, the palm and the coconut oils, which will not cause heart attacks, and promoted corn oil. And there you have it. Now,
about olive oil?
Olive oil is only 90%, only 10% polyunsaturated and 90% monounsaturated. So it is not going to block your arteries like the other liquid oils. But, of course, you wouldn't want to use it in excessive amounts because it still is 10% polyunsaturated.
So you're saying that butter is the healthiest, or coconut oil?
Butter, coconut, palm.
Okay, thank you.
And saturated fats from animals like beef and lamb.
Okay, thanks for your call. We have another caller on the air, so let's get this next one.
Yes, hi, George from Kentucky.
Hey, George, thanks for joining us from Kentucky.
My question is twofold. I've been reading about black tourmaline or aragonite, as being helpful or effective against EMF, and I was curious to know what you felt was helpful or protective in fighting against EMF.
Okay, are those like those beads that you can put on the end of your cable? Is that what you're talking about?
No, black tourmaline is a stone. He's not talking about the...
don't they make beads out of
the antenna blockers. No, that's a different compound. That's graphene, or not graphene, I think it's graphite. Yeah.
It's a crystal.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pete,
for a laptop, you know, with the electromagnetic field, you get the, harmful electromagnetic field. So I was curious if you felt the crystals were effective in
blocking that.
Blocking that, exactly.
No, it takes something that is basically covering the space between you and the source geometrically. Something that is a small area just can't catch a broad emission coming at you.
So it's like they have these things called block socks for your cell phone. So the side of your cell phone that has an antenna that radiates to get its signal, if you put that block sock, it has this metal barrier next to your body and the phone faces out, then it's not going to be penetrating you the same way as if you didn't have that block sock. Does that make sense?
So I guess just to reiterate, how do we exactly protect ourselves from EMF of the laptop computer then? I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow. I understood the analogy for cell phones, but I didn't quite understand for a laptop.
Just think of it as light that's coming from your computer or whatever, and if the light is touching some important part of your body, the rays, whatever they are, microwaves, are going to be following the line of sight, so you need something basically as big as the object emitting to catch the radiation.
I see. Okay. So would you suggest, would you suggest just placing the laptop on a table or a surface and not obviously using it on top of your lap, say on a pillow or something like that?
Yeah, the lap is not a good place to keep a radiant source.
Potentially, you see, you could use an external keyboard on your laptop and then put the laptop underneath the table or in a slot like that to block the EMF from the laptop, and then use a monitor also connected to your laptop. You could just use your laptop as the processor.
And you can get a little EMF monitor, and you can see on your laptop it reads danger.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
And 6 inches away, it doesn't pick up any EMF. I mean, that's a real rough, crude monitor you can buy at the hardware store. But, you know, keep it as far away from your body as possible, basically.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Well, thank you all. I appreciate your help.
Yeah,
thank you for your call.
Appreciate your call. Okay. I don't know if there's anybody else waiting. Okay. So we're getting very close to the top of the hour anyway. So
we could make a connection between the connections about the unsaturated fat and the fact that fish oil happens to be one of the very best activators of the heme oxygenase, which makes carbon monoxide, and in proportion to how polyunsaturated a fat is, it activates the production of carbon monoxide.
So if someone had Alzheimer's and they're taking fish oil, it's a really bad combination.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing that I would imagine most of the industry is telling you is good for Alzheimer's and good for chronic obstructive lung disease and things like atrial fibrillation and other cardiovascular disorders. Bizarre.
We have one quick question about horse meat. Is that good or bad?
It depends on what the horse is eating, but it'll reflect exactly what the horse ate. So it's very likely to be fairly unsaturated, unless in some countries they feed them, for example, dates were a major food in Iraq, and they would have a very saturated fat if they ate dates.
Okay, so let's wrap the show up by giving people some of your contact details, Dr. Pete. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so Dr. Raymond Peete, he's been working on many things surrounding current, what are becoming very current health topics, and the polyunsaturated oils are one of his mainstays, but he's done lots of research into things that are surrounding cancer treatment. So his website is www.raypeete.com, R-A-Y-P-E-A-T.com. He has lots of articles there that you can go and browse. Many of it, well, they're all fully referenced. Some are quite difficult to get into because they're very scientific, but there's lots of information in there that most people will find the truth of behind. Thank you for joining us.
My name's Sarah Murray.
My name's Andrew.